I'm Joy Manning, editor of Edible Philly.
And I'm Marisa McClellan, author of Food in Jars.
Welcome to Local Mouthful. We're here to talk about living the food life in Philadelphia and beyond. This week, we'll talk about pumpkin spice, as in pumpkin spice lattes, nonstick cookware, and making dinner with Molly Watson. But first, let's compare notes on something we read this week. Marisa, what have you got?
Well, it's on the topic of the pumpkin spice and the pumpkin spice latte. So it is officially pumpkin spice latte season. And the big news this year was that the Starbucks pumpkin spice lattes actually contained pumpkin puree. In the past, it has just been a plain old latte with spices. And I've never understood why people go so crazy over a latte that has had like a sweet syrup with cinnamon and nutmeg and ginger and cloves and allspice and sometimes mace added to their latte. Like, that's it. It's sweet and it's spicy and people go nuts for it.
I think people go nuts because it's an emblem of the seasons changing. And I mean, yeah. I can't even believe I'm going to say these words. The holidays coming. I think it is more that more than the flavor itself.
Yeah.
What has been more mysterious to me, though, is this indignation over it not having pumpkin in it, which has never – that just doesn't make any sense. Pumpkin spice isn't pumpkin.
Yeah.
It's the pie spices. It's the fragrance. It's not supposed to taste like squash, right?
Yeah, that has been how it's been in the past. But this year, I guess they're adding some small amount.
Just to give in to those crazy people.
Yes. Yes. And I mean, there have long been copycat recipes online that include pumpkin for those people who feel like, well, it's a pumpkin latte. But no, it's a pumpkin spice latte. But here's the crazy part. So, you know, people have been all about pumpkin spice for a very long time. And this year I actually read some sort of little news snippet or a press release saying that the popularity of pumpkin spice was actually declining this year for the first time in years. So maybe it is that they put the pumpkin in the pumpkin spice latte. I don't know.
And people don't like it?
I guess not.
I don't know. I mean, I like those pumpkin pie spices as much as anyone else. And I certainly look forward to actual pumpkin pie.
Yeah.
Did you know that I used to work at Starbucks?
I did not know that.
It's one of my many jobs that I had in college. And I don't think we had the pumpkin spice lattes. Mm-hmm. And I don't think they existed at that time. But I did discover through working at Starbucks that I really am a kind of a purist about coffee. I don't really like frappuccinos or any type of – I just like a basic coffee drink, sometimes black, sometimes with cream.
Yeah.
People that go crazy over this flavored drinks, including the pumpkin spice, they're not my coffee tribe.
No, I agree. And I think this might be why we're friends, Joy, is that I am also equally simplistic when it comes to my coffee. Although I feel like in this, you know, crazy new third wave coffee movement we find ourselves in, I'm actually not as purist as some people because I do like a splash of dairy product in my coffee. I can't drink black coffee. It's just – it doesn't work for me.
Oh, you know, I'm kind of a – wishy-washy about coffee. Most people, I guess, drink their coffee the same way all the time, whereas like I'm really flexible. I'll take it with milk or black, with sugar or without, like whatever. I like it in all of its guises except flavors. No thank you on the flavors.
I was just at a grocery store this weekend and they had a whole display of pumpkin spice things. So there were pumpkin spice Oreos, there were pumpkin spice like sandwich cracker things, like those peanut butter cracker sandwiches that you get in little packages.
That's so interesting.
There was pumpkin spice like coffee mixes, hot chocolate.
I have seen a pumpkin spice candle, I think.
Yeah.
So which makes sense in a way.
It does. I mean, it really is just cinnamon, nutmeg, ginger, allspice, cloves,
those
and
warming,
sometimes mace, which are spices I love.
Warming, wintry smells and tastes.
I often make jam with, you know, cinnamon and nutmeg and maybe some ginger or cloves because it does lend that sort of holiday spirit.
Festive.
It is festive. I just never call it pumpkin spice.
Right. Well, maybe you should, and you could start selling tons of jam if that was your
maybe.
Ambition, which I know
maybe.
It's not. Anyway, let's talk about what we're eating for dinner this week, or maybe what we wish we were. I'm not invited to any potlucks this week, but if I were, I have some ideas about what I would make.
Do you? Well, I feel like autumn, or, you know, this time of year, fall, is definitely the start of the potluck season. I don't know. I mean, I know people potluck in summer, but I feel like summer gatherings are more like picnic-y, and there's something about that back to school season for me that screams potluck. It could be partially that I grew up going to a Unitarian church in Portland, Oregon, and they, all of the kids' choirs practiced on Monday nights, and they used to have this organized family potluck every Monday night before the kids' choir, so that parents didn't have to worry about, you know, getting their kids fed for dinner. We'd have this big community meal. And they started at the beginning of the school year. So for me, this time of year screams potluck.
I feel like 50% of the potlucks I've ever been to in my life have been yours.
Well, yeah, my love of the potluck is well documented. There's something so special to me about a meal where people collaborate and bring food to share. And I also just love tasting other people's food, you know. I have this problem, which is that no matter what I make, no matter whose recipe I follow, I feel like my food always tastes like my food. And potlucks are this amazing opportunity to taste other people's food, and they're family food. It's not fancy food. It's sort of just, you know, the salad you make, which is, you know, mundane to you. But to me, like, I've had your salads, Joy. You make this really good shallot creamy vinaigrette and it's delicious.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome. So to me, potlucks are just a great way to build community and share food, and I love them. And so for dinner, I don't have any potlucks on the horizon, but maybe we have to plan a local mouthful potluck. But one of my favorite things to make this time of year for a potluck is just a big pasta bake with lots of greens and maybe some ricotta cheese. It can have meat in it or not, but it's hearty and filling, and I do it with whole grain pasta so that it has a little bit of virtuosity. And it's one that if a kid can get over the presence of green, they typically like.
It's a crowd pleaser.
It is a crowd pleaser.
You know what crowd pleasing thing I like to bring to a potluck?
What?
Guacamole.
Oh, yum.
And one reason I like to bring this is because it doesn't need to be heated.
Yeah.
I think that I always worry about like breaking whatever the unspoken rules are of having a potluck. And I think that guacamole is just a no fail.
Yeah.
It's a risk-free option. True. Everyone loves it. It goes with everything, according to me.
Yeah.
And it does not require any special oven space or anything like that.
That is true.
What do you think are the rules when it comes to potlucks? I'm always just guessing what they are.
Well, I feel like it depends on the crowd you're you know, potlucking with. Definitely bringing something that doesn't need any prep once you arrive at your potluck destination is nice. So like for my pasta bake, I cook it off right before I leave. So I have a hot dish coming, and then it's good warm or at room temperature. So I think you're right about not wanting to do a lot of assembly or heating at wherever you're going for the potluck.
What's the most irritating thing someone has brought to your potluck?
I think it's the most irritating or just the hardest thing is when someone brings something that needs lots of assembly.
Like what?
And they don't bring anything to assemble it with. So it's like they bring maybe some cheese and bread, but without any sort of vessel to put it on, so that they basically say, hey, can I borrow a cutting board? Hey, can I borrow a knife? Hey, can I, you know, my feeling is that whatever you bring to a potluck, anything really goes as long as you can just kind of put it out. So I always bring a serving utensil for whatever I've brought. If I'm bringing, you know, something that needs assembly, I bring the dishes or the boards on which to assemble it.
I do like to bring something in a slow cooker. That way that can just be plugged in and there it is.
And if you're going to do something like that, I love bringing things in slow cookers. It's always good to warn hey, can you save me a spot? Or should I bring an extension cord or something? Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's a good way to go too. My guiding rule with a potluck is to simply bring something that I know that I'm going to enjoy eating. And if no one brings anything else, that I can make a meal out of. So, you know, with your guacamole, it's pretty easy to make a meal of chips and guacamole.
I agree. I don't know if everyone would agree with that, but I totally agree.
Or like, you know, the pasta bake. Or I also tend to try to bring something that has some vegetable matter in it. So just because I know that I'm going to want to eat vegetables for dinner and I can't rely on other people to fulfill my vegetable needs.
Do you give guests guidance when it comes to potlucks? Do you tell them what to bring?
No, I'm a believer in a true potluck where you...
Emphasis on the luck.
Yes, where you just tell people to bring something that they want to eat.
Oh, you have 9 desserts? Tough luck.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like there are always going to be some potlucks where you know, there's a lot of bread and wine and nothing else, or all desserts and nothing else. But that's part of the joy of the potluck, is that you have that variety. But what ends up happening over time, especially if you potluck with a community over time, is that people, the rhythm of the potluck emerges. And so people tend to bring things that turn into a meal. And I think that that's part of the joy of it, is that seeing the meal sort of emerge as people arrive is really fun.
This is just another one of the examples, the inspiring examples that you have given me over the years of your faith in the universe.
Well, you know, it's true. But also, I think that the best part about a potluck is simply the people getting together. And as long as you have people, you can make a meal out of anything.
That's very sweet, Marisa.
I don't know. I think it's true. I think it's true.
I think you're right.
So enough about potlucks. Let's talk a little bit about nonstick cookware, a controversial subject, if ever there was one.
It is controversial.
Yeah. I love some of my nonstick pans. I still use a couple of nonstick skillets. How about you, Joy?
I wouldn't say I love them, but I will say that I need them.
Yeah.
I make so many scrambled eggs. Like, and I just can't work out how to make scrambled eggs in a pan that is not a nonstick. And, I mean, some people have this idea that a perfectly seasoned cast iron pan is as good as nonstick. That is not even true.
Yeah.
In my experience.
I love my nonstick pans for egg cooking and the occasional like crepe. I don't make crepes often, but they're so much easier to do in a nonstick. I do have one well-seasoned cast iron pan that I do use to make omelets, but I feel like omelets are different from scrambled eggs, because you're actually trying to, you know, the secret to even a well-seasoned cast iron pan is that you're still going to need to let the food cook until it sort of releases. Mm-hmm. And so with an omelet, I don't mind a little browning and having the eggs sort of cook until they release. But with scrambled eggs, you want them to be soft and fluffy. And in order to get that from any other – a pan that's not nonstick, you basically are bathing them in butter, which, while delicious, is not what you want to do every day.
Right, right.
And so, yeah, I think nonstick – I have a couple of nonstick skillets, and then I have a nonstick muffin tin that I love.
Do you have a brand that you like?
I do. I have three Calphalon nonstick pans. And I got my start on these nonsticks because I got a free itty bitty nonstick skillet at a conference I went to a few years ago. And I used it and loved it so much that I bought two more pans in a larger size. And they are so good. They are just so nonstick. The surface has been holding up really well for the last couple of years, because that's the problem with nonstick, is that you either buy cheap nonstick that you would then end up throwing out after 6 or 9 months, or you pay more money, but then it's still not going to last forever. And so finding that balance of sort of price point and durability is hard.
My current nonstick pan is from IKEA, and it's terrible.
Is it terrible?
I have an extra complication because I cook on induction, and I think I might have been at that same conference where you got that original pan, and it didn't work on my stove.
Oh, no.
Because of, it's just not induction compatible.
Yeah, it's aluminum, I think.
So that makes it a challenge for me. And then there's also the health concerns with nonsticks. The fumes are potentially carcinogenic. I don't think there's like definitive science on it, but it doesn't, I mean, it is something I'd rather avoid.
Yeah.
And to that end, we recently, Dan picked out, what are they called? Carbon steel. Carbon steel pan. And apparently there's like a different way of seasoning it. He's been using flaxseed oil. And I mean, this is the seasoning of this new pan has been like a 2 months long process. We've yet to cook a single egg in it. And I'm still cursing my terrible IKEA pan every morning. So
yeah,
you guys will have to stay tuned to find out if the carbon steel pan ever works. Have you ever used one?
No, it's funny. I actually just this last weekend was in a cookware store and found myself sort of gently stroking a Lodge carbon steel pan, thinking about adding it to my kitchen, then decided against it. I had one once, an old carbon steel crepe pan that I had picked up at a thrift store, but I couldn't get through the seasoning. Mm-hmm. I couldn't commit to the amount of seasoning it required to get to a usable point. And so I surrendered and returned it to the thrift store.
Well, the thing is that restaurants don't use nonstick pans for the most part. Yeah. They use carbon steel or mm-hmm. stainless steel. And I guess they just are not shy about putting a ridiculous amount of fat in the pan to keep it. I don't know what the secret is. I haven't cracked it yet. I'm going to keep working on it. If readers have any tips on making a carbon steel, I'm sorry, listeners have any tips on making a carbon steel pan perfectly nonstick, please send them to me. I really need your help.
Yeah. Have you tried one more thing about nonstick? Have you tried any of the ceramic, like those eco green ceramic nonstick pans?
No, but when I was working at Prevention, we did a test of mm-hmm. a lot of different types in the test kitchen there, and none of them really work.
I had one that worked for a while, but it only held its nonstick for like 4 months before it started to go, and I couldn't justify continuing to buy. Like, it worked beautifully. Magically for a little while, and then it was done.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't buy another one with a 4 month lifespan, and I was gentle with it.
Right.
So
maybe the technology will improve.
But I do love the Calphalon ones. I will confess they have been great, but I baby them like crazy trying to, you know.
Oh, I do too. Yeah. Even with my crummy IKEA pan.
And, you know, one of the things too.
And by baby, we mean you don't scrub it out with a, you know, and you don't use a metal utensil on mm-hmm. it.
I'm blah, so blah. Careful. And I always cook over medium heat. I never take it over high because that's when you get those they say the dangerous fumes really happen over higher heats. Mm-hmm. So I try to keep it on medium heat and not abuse that nonstick surface.
Smart.
But it's an imperfect, but they sure cook eggs beautifully. Today we're talking with food writer, recipe developer, and brand and content strategist Molly Watson. Molly has a piece in the 2015 edition of Best Food Writing about how cooking isn't for everyone. Today we're going to talk about cooking, not cooking, and the growing bevy of options for people who need to get dinner on the table. Hey, Molly.
Hey.
Thanks for doing this.
Oh, I'm happy to be here.
I'm glad you're here. I'm glad I'm here. We are actually in Molly's home in San Francisco, which is extra fun. Not in my living room in Philadelphia, which is always nice to get out of. So, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Oh, a little bit about myself. Well, on this particular topic that we're talking about, yes. I would say that I became a food writer 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. I finished grad school and decided to go into food writing because I love cooking. I love cooking a lot. And I had really been cooking since I was a kid, always really loved it. And throughout the entire time I was in grad school, I actually would reward if I got my stuff done each day to myself is then I would get to go shopping and make dinner. I mean, you know, I'd go to the grocery store, I'd go to the farmer's market, and I would cook, you know, often some pretty elaborate things. And I really used the thing I loved about cooking compared to the academic work was that I would spend all day reading or writing these things that in the morning there would just be more of it to do. And it was very abstract and not that many other people were very interested in it. I mean, except the other academics, but it wasn't something I could really share with that many people. And then I would cook and I would make this food and I would spend this time and I would get a lot of immediate gratification and feedback from other people who liked eating it.
Yeah.
And then in the morning, it was just gone. I never had to think about that ravioli again. It was over. And it was such the opposite of what my work was at the time that it was just this really perfect compliment. So that was why I loved it. And I decided to go into food writing. And so it was kind of natural and it was kind of right around as like the good food movement, as we know it now, was really ramping up. So, you know, Alice Waters, Michael Pollan, all that stuff was really kind of much more coming into people's attention. And it really greatly appealed to me. So I very quickly got on the Everyone Should Be Cooking bandwagon. Yeah. And I was up front leading that parade. I really, deep in my soul, believed that if everyone cooked, it would change the world. And I also, I think, wasn't really conscious of this, but I think I thought like, well, I like cooking so much, like other people would like it if they just gave it a try, if they just knew how they would love it too.
Yeah.
So that's why I kind of got started food writing.
Yeah. I remember you even used to have a blog dedicated to dinner, the Dinner Files.
The Dinner Files.
Which was always really fun. And you shared the food you were making, which was great.
So I actually started that. So I was a food writer for a while. And then still am, but I was freelance for a while, and then I worked at Sunset Magazine, which I'm not sure how many of your listeners will have heard of it, but it's very big on the West Coast.
I feel like it's sort of iconic.
It is, yeah. But a lot of people on the East Coast don't know about it.
I guess that's true.
But it is a magazine. It's a lifestyle magazine for the West Coast, and they have a big food department, a very important part of the magazine, and I worked there for three years, and it's about a 30 to 45 minute commute from my house.
Yeah.
And I worked there in the food department, developed recipes and wrote stories. And it was the kind of place, you know, I went into the office every day and did that and worked in the test kitchen and had and wrote stories and everything. And at that point I had, my son was in preschool. And I really, all of a sudden, the complaints other people had about cooking just smacked me in the face. And I was like, and part of it was I would spend, you know, some of my days I would spend in the test kitchen. So I'd cook all day and I definitely didn't feel like cooking when I got home. And luckily, a lot of times, I mean, I'd try to strategize my recipe development so that I would be working on at least something that would work as dinner if I brought it home.
Very smart.
Right. But sometimes, you know, we were baking cakes all day.
Yeah.
So I would have to, we would have to do something. But it was really the first time that making dinner wasn't fun.
Yeah.
Because before that, if I ever didn't feel like cooking, it wasn't that often. And so we would just go out and get takeout and it wasn't a big deal. But all of a sudden, I didn't feel like cooking most days.
Which is a whole different thing and makes it a lot harder.
It's a whole different thing. And I think also, you know, it just was a different time in my life and a certain level of maturity and realizing like, oh, wait, lots of people like gardening, but I don't like it.
Yeah.
And realizing, well, other people just don't like cooking.
It is true. I was reminded of this recently. My mom is a perfectly serviceable cook, but she is very much, she eats because she has to and she cooks because it's the way to eat healthfully. But if she could stop cooking for the rest of her life and eat, live on pellets, she would.
And my mom is the same
is
way.
She?
Yeah, totally. Completely. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It shocks me because I love to cook and I love to eat. And I learned to cook from my mom, but she's very much like, if I didn't have to do this ever again, I'd be okay with that.
Yeah, I think my mom's the same way. I mean, I think, yeah, she wants it. She wants to be able to offer people a nice meal because she wants the gathering to be nice.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, if she didn't have to, if just on a daily basis, she could just not deal with it, be super psyched. Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about the piece that's going to be in Best Food Writing.
Yeah, so I guess I started talking about this because we had been talking about this piece. And so this piece sort of traces just also, you know, part my own developed like shift of kind of saying everyone should be cooking to sort of slowly realizing why everyone wasn't cooking.
Mm-hmm.
And still kind of thinking they should, you know. And then a more recent honest like reaction. Kind of seeing what's been happening, I feel like that rhetoric in the good food movement is still there.
Yeah.
That's very much still the discourse, and there's a lot of pressure on it. And honestly, just starting to really see the degree to which I think it's bullshit. the more and more I learned about what's happening in our food system, and the more I looked around at how people are living and eating, I just started seeing lots. First of all, I think there are so many other points where we could be fixing the food system that would be more impactful than trying to get individuals to buy better food and cook it themselves. It's like, I totally get it. I do think if people cook regularly, they eat better and they care more about their food. I think that's absolutely true. Mm-hmm. I think there's a real limit to the kind of change that can come from that. And part of that is only so many people are going to like cooking. Only so many people are going to have the time to cook. And these are not things we're going to be able to fix.
Yeah,
like
absolutely.
That's just set. And there's just so many other entry points. You know, when to me, like the much bigger problems are things like a farm bill that's subsidizing certain crops. So it's not a level playing field.
Yes.
Soy and corn are way cheaper than broccoli. And it's not for any reason other than subsidy. Well, there might be other reasons, I don't know. But subsidies are playing a part.
Yeah,
let's
huge
put it
part.
That way.
Yeah.
A huge disproportional part. So you have all these super cheap ingredients that then, you know, big companies are spending a lot of money engineering food so that we will crave it. You know, using knowledge about our brain chemistry and biology and how all these things to make it so that we crave this food that's cheaper than the good food, but infinitely worse for us. And these are things that I feel are much, you know, aren't going to, they're fought if people are cooking because they're probably going to cook better food than that. but they're bigger problems in a lot of ways than whether someone's cooking. And I also, when I say it's bullshit, like that's part of it.
Mm-hmm.
There are other points that I think are equally, I think there are real limits to ethical consumerism. In short, like in a system where corporations are people, I think there's a real limit to that. There's a limit to like you can get a lot of individuals, but what you really need is the buying power of the big, you need to change the whole game.
Yeah.
And that's not going to work at the individual level. But on a less practical, but just more cultural note,
mm-hmm.
the bullshit I saw was I just started, you know, we still see domestic labor falls disproportionately on women, even when everyone works in a household.
Yeah.
And so when you're telling people to cook, you're kind of telling women that they should be cooking.
True. Yes.
I mean, just by that's just what's happening in most households. And that's just messed up. And I got honestly kind of sick of, I'll just say it. I got kind of sick of these older dudes whose job it is to cook dinner for a living, telling people they should be cooking when they're kind of telling women they should be cooking. And there's just something a wee bit sexist about it that I started having a lot of trouble swallowing.
I can
honestly
see that. Yeah.
Yeah. So that is definitely part of it. And part of it also was just, you know, that realization that I had when I was working at Sunset, where it's like, well, it's easy enough for me to tell people they should be cooking. That's my job.
Yeah.
You know? And so then when I left Sunset, I started the blog, The Dinner Files, and I started it for a lot of reasons. It was mainly just to keep to, when you work in a magazine, you're really working in that magazine's voice. Mm-hmm. And I had been there a while. And so I wanted to kind of find my own rhythm again. And that's why I started it. Yeah. And I just figured, I also kind of thought, oh, it'd be interesting because people were always like, oh, you're a food writer, you must eat amazing meals every night. And it's like, sometimes, and sometimes like we're eating some weird stuff because that's what I had to cook for work. No one in the house is very happy. And yes, you cook dinner, but no one's that appreciative.
It's true.
So part of it was I wanted to show people, oh, here's what I'm actually eating every mm-hmm. night. And then part of doing that was also like, yeah, it's my job to make dinner every day and I shouldn't be telling other people how to spend their time.
Yeah.
So I really switched to a much more like, hey, if you want to cook, like I am super psyched to show you how to do that. But if you don't, that's awesome. You know, true. Or maybe you want to cook once and you want to try this and this would be a really easy thing to do. And I just started really trying to present things in a way that was more honest to mm-hmm. how I saw things working.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Well, and I feel like that takes us to what you're doing now.
Yeah.
Where, when you want to tell us what you're doing these days?
Yeah. So I am working for a company called Munchery mm-hmm. and they're here in San Francisco and they also, are in Seattle and New York and Los Angeles. And they actually contacted me right after this piece appeared in Edible San Francisco last winter. So the timing was really interesting.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it was great. Because in the piece, part of what I talk about is I get to this place where I'm like, this is bullshit. And before I was a food writer, I was a historian. So I started thinking about communal kitchens
because uh-huh.
that was a big thing in the early 20th century because getting dinner on the table has been a problem for a long time.
True enough.
It's always been a problem and people have kind of solved it through the ages either with monotony or money.
Yeah.
So you either had the same thing all the time or, you know, the sort of classic 50s housewife pork chops on Tuesdays rotation or you had enough money to hire someone to cook for you. But in those middle places, one of the solutions that was, and it was always seen as or at certain points in the early 20th century anyway, a lot of people saw it as a feminist problem too.
Yeah.
Like how, women are doing the cooking. So if they're working, who's going to feed everybody? So communal kitchens were one of the answers. And one day I was doing recipes for, I had a column in the San Francisco Chronicle last year. I was doing recipes for it and I was doing the three recipes at once. So it's a fair amount of cooking, but it's not totally out of sync with what you might make on a weekend for, you know, people. And I just read a big article about the drought in California was just because I just read it, I was hyper aware of how much water I was using while I was in the kitchen. And I started thinking, does this really even make sense? Like the communal kitchen isn't just a labor thing. It's perfectly reasonable to think that it might be a water and energy saving thing. Like it's not very efficient to have all of these different households cooking their own dinner every night.
Yeah, that's really true.
And also on the food waste front, like so much food gets wasted mm-hmm. in this country. And a lot of that is at a household level.
Yeah.
So what if there was better planning going on? And so the people at Munchery called me. They were looking for someone. They had not used a writer. They had just been doing everything on their site. Sort of the chefs would write some stuff, and the marketing people would write some stuff, and the engineers would put things on that they needed. And
oh, wow.
Nothing was coming together. And they had a really clear like visual brand happening, mm-hmm. and they really wanted to bring some voice in with that. And so they asked me if I would come in and help with that. And I did. And then things went well enough that they offered me a job and I decided to take it. So I've been doing that for a couple months now, working with them on the branding and content strategy. And what they do, and the reason that I was interested, is they deliver dinner to people. But it's not like Caviar or Seamless. They're not bringing it from restaurants. They actually have a central kitchen in each of their cities where chefs make the food. And it gets chilled and packaged and brought to people. And you heat it up. It has heating instructions. Mm-hmm. And the reason they do the chilled is that you can just do a lot more. Like the economies of scale are much better. And you also have a lot more flexibility in the menu if you're not trying to deliver hot food.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, there's a lot of protein. I mean, especially fish and stuff actually works better if you do it this way. A lot of more delicate things are easier actually to heat up than to keep warm.
Yeah.
And then the other kind of cool thing is you can do something like tacos where the meat gets heated up, but the toppings don't. So there's a lot of stuff like that. And then, you know, they have salads and all this other stuff. And, you know, I was looking at what they're doing and I find it really exciting. I mean, it's a real solution to dinner, honestly, like having that kind of thing. In some places where they're offered, you can just get it on demand. You know, you can order dinner at 6 mm-hmm. and it's there in 30 minutes. Ready for you.
Kind of amazing.
Other places that are further out, you have to schedule your delivery earlier in the day so they get stuff. But still, they're trying to hit that pain point. It was actually started by these two dads, and the founder talks about he was the one who cooked in his family.
Yeah.
And they had two kids, and his wife had this high-powered job, and he had this job. And he was just getting takeout all the time, you know, and was bummed about it because he liked to cook, but just didn't have the time. And he really thought like there has to be a better way. And he's kind of over time came up with this, and it is working. And I get really excited and I just think about the kind of buying power they have at the volumes they're working at. You know, they're getting to this place where we're, you know, buying, you know, the organic kale from this one farm and featuring that. And it's not always that way yet. Like, it's not all organic yet or anything like that, but it's getting to a place where they're going to be big enough to be able to offer that in a much more regular way. And at prices that, you know, might not be fully a daily option for a lot of people, but are probably that weekly or twice weekly takeout night kind of thing.
And certainly probably healthier and, you know, just generally a little fresher than what you get from takeout.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. In fact, well, so the last few months we've been eating a lot of Munchery at our house. I mean, I like to try all the things. And now that I'm at a full-time job again, instead of freelancing out of this nice room we're sitting in, I have that exact thing that I was writing about, which is like, I have every best, most mornings I start off with the best intention of making dinner that night. And I'm married to someone, he does a lot of cooking, so he cooks a lot of nights. Mm-hmm. But I will start off with the best intention of I'm going to cook. And at 5:15, and I'm still at the office, I find myself on my phone ordering dinner to be sent over to the house.
Yeah.
So we've been eating a lot of Munchery. And then this last weekend, we're like, oh, let's get Chinese. We haven't had Chinese in so long. And there's this Chinese place that we always used to get delivery from, mm-hmm. like once a week, three times a month, something like that. And we got the food and we're eating it. We're like, this isn't like, it just did not have the same appeal at all. Yeah. Like it was so, and I mean, I love it, but it was like that greasy, heavy kind of, and granted, that's the place we chose. There's plenty of places in San Francisco that we could have gotten delicious takeout from. But it was just this thing of like, oh, this used to be our sort of like takeout delivery option. And it like didn't feel that way anymore. It was so funny because I think we were all a little bit sick or jaded on Munchery because it had been months of eating a lot of it.
Yeah.
And my husband and my son were both like, wow, like this really makes me appreciate what we get at Munchery. Like, that is good food.
It's like you're your own testimonial here.
A little bit. I actually had that moment of like, I got a little excited about it, you know, with jobs, it's always up and down a little bit.
It's true.
It was that moment of like, oh yeah, this is actually cool. This is cool.
That's awesome. Well, hopefully, you know, Munchery hasn't come to Philadelphia yet, but I think if it was there, you know, I feel like it would be a good solution for me too, because I certainly get to that point where if, you know, I've been working all day, I'm working on a book or something, or if I don't take time out to start something at like 3 or 3:30 so I can keep working till 6 or 6:30, it doesn't happen. And then it's 7 and I haven't figured out anything. And I'm like, oh, we're going to go get sandwiches.
Yeah.
And that's
okay. Yeah. But well, and I think that's the thing, is there just need to be a lot of options.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what I liked about what Munchery is doing. I think they're doing it in this really smart way that can potentially scale to actually work for lots of people. And that also changes, you know, the pricing of it so that it's more affordable.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of things like that I find really interesting on the business side with them. But it's also really exciting. I mean, there's just tons of places doing different kinds of things, trying to solve the dinner problem, you know? And I think what's really cool, what's happening in San Francisco a lot anyway, just with all the tech, is there is starting to be some merging of that. I mean, Munchery, it's really a tech company in a lot of ways, because it's the way the app can work and the way that the tech on the, you know, behind the scenes with operations allows them to a lot of stuff, and with the drivers and the delivery, like all of that. When I started learning about it, I was just like, this is mind blowing, what you have to do.
Yeah.
But there's other companies, you know, who are doing some stuff with that too. And it's kind of cool just seeing the different kinds of options that are there.
Yeah.
You know, like there's this option and there's, you know, other companies that are doing it different ways. And I just think there's a lot happening in that space right now that's really exciting, especially if you don't feel like cooking.
Yeah.
You know, there's going to be more options for that situation, which I find great.
Yeah, I think it's terrific. And it'll be really interesting because I feel like we're in the sort of wild west of the dinner solution, the dinner problem finding a solution. And so hopefully over the next 5 or 10 years, this will really evolve into so many options that work for as many people as possible. So it's kind of exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. It is very exciting.
Well, Molly, thank you so much for doing this interview with us. And hopefully we'll get to talk again sometime.
I'd love to.
Sounds good. That was Molly Watson. She is a recipe developer, food writer, and content and brand strategist based in San Francisco.
Well, I think now it's time for us to go to the grocery market. And you told me that this week you are buying pumpkins.
Yes. For me, I love to buy pumpkins this time of year because they're just so abundant. And I know most people are buying pumpkins to decorate with.
Which are not good for cooking.
No. But I buy my favorites are like a Cinderella pumpkin or a fairy tale pumpkin. So little ones. I don't know if that's the official name, but the sugar pumpkins. So you want to you go to the farmer's market, get the ones that are good for cooking, and you can just do so much with them. They're like any other winter squash. So, you know, if pumpkin feels a step too far for you, you can do these things with like a butternut or an acorn. But to me, there's something really special about actually cooking a delicious pumpkin. And so I love the ones with all the warts on the outside because those warts are an indication of sugar content.
Oh, interesting.
So when you buy a pumpkin that has all those little warts on the outside, it is going to be super sweet. And so my favorite thing to do is line a roasting pan or a sheet pan with some tinfoil, because those high sugar pumpkins are going to bleed juice that's going to burn. And I like to not have to scrub that off of my baking sheets. So I line it with foil or parchment, and then I stab a pumpkin with a knife a couple times so that it has some space for the steam to escape. And then I just plunk it on the roasting pan, put it in the oven at like 375 for maybe half an hour to 40 minutes, and it'll start to melt. It'll slump into itself. And as soon as it's fork tender, you take it out, let it cool till it's handleable, and then you can just kind of pull it apart and scrape all that flesh out. And that can be you can turn that into pumpkin bread. You can use it. One of my mom gave me this recipe once that I only make maybe once a year because it's so rich and decadent. But oh my God, is it good. It's a pumpkin and potato casserole. It's like a squash bake. So you combine one part mashed potatoes with one part pumpkin puree, and you can use canned, but I love to do it roast my own. And then you stir in some butter and some eggs and some cheese, and then you top it with Gruyere and you bake it.
That sounds very Thanksgiving-y.
It is super Thanksgiving-y. It is a great potluck dish too, because it's a really interesting side, and it's got some pumpkin for the people who love pumpkin, but some potato to make it sort of less aggressively squashy. And it is so good. It is just one of these delicious things. I also if I'm working with pumpkin and I don't want to roast it, if I want pumpkin pieces, one of my favorite things in the world is pumpkin curry. There's a restaurant that every time I go to visit my parents in Portland, Oregon, called Monsoon Tide, and they serve this pumpkin. It's a red curry with big hunks of pumpkin in it, and the pumpkin is not like melting into nothing. It's firm chunks of pumpkin that are fully cooked, and they're a little bit like dry and sweet, and they soak up the curry juice. And so a couple of times I've made my own pumpkin curry, and it is so good.
I've made curries with a butternut squash, yeah, which is probably very similar.
So, Joy, I'm ranting about pumpkin here. How do you feel? Have you ever cooked a pumpkin from scratch?
I can't say that I've really cooked with pumpkin that I've picked up at the farmer's market. I have obviously cooked with canned pumpkin. Yeah. You know, sometimes I end up developing these light, healthy recipes for food magazines. And I remember once doing like a macaroni and cheese that was like half pumpkin or part pumpkin because it's orange and looks like cheese and has a certain richness.
God, that sounds good.
It's just okay.
Is it just okay?
It's not macaroni and cheese. It is. It's nice. I've done like a sauce with canned pumpkin too for pasta, like with cream and sage.
Yeah.
But in terms of like buying a pumpkin, and I haven't really done that. Maybe you'll inspire me to pick one up
soon. I think you should try it. Another good one is pumpkin risotto.
Yes. I have made that with canned pumpkin as well. And I do enjoy a pumpkin ravioli.
Yeah. So I think, Joy, I think you should try cooking a pumpkin from scratch. Get one of the really warty ones. You know, and I feel like the flavor, it just has more flavor.
I will. I'll do it.
Yeah. I think you'd like it.
Do you make pumpkin pie around Thanksgiving?
I do. And I have made pumpkin pie with...
From pumpkins.
Mm. You know, the secret to pumpkin puree at the grocery store is often it's not actually pumpkin. Most of the time it's butternut squash.
Oh, I didn't know that. Yeah. I thought it was like another type of squash.
No, most of the time it's actually butternut squash. So... Mm. It's fun to actually make pumpkin pie when you know that you're doing it with real pumpkin.
Actual pumpkins.
Yeah. Another good one is Ruth Reichel has this classic recipe where she opens up a pumpkin and then fills it with like cheese and sauteed onions and bread and makes a panade built in a pumpkin and then roasts it all. It's like a Thanksgiving main course for people who, aren't doing a turkey.
Hmm.
And that's a fun one to look up to because it I've never made it, but it sounds so good. I'll try
to find
the
link to that.
Yeah.
We'll share it in the show notes if I can find it.
It sounds good. All right. Enough waxing poetic about pumpkin. It is time to wrap it up. So thank you for listening this week. Our big thanks go out to Dan Call for being our editor, as well as to Raina Rose for providing our music. And thank you guys for listening. If you like what you hear, make sure to subscribe via iTunes or your favorite podcast app. And follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Local Mouthful. We're also on Facebook at facebook.com/localmouthful. You can also sign up for our newsletter and catch up on all our episodes and show notes at localmouthful.com. Until next time, happy eating.